Blog Talk Radio.
Guys, it was a pretty tough week out there for some of the fighters. One in particular, he had a very gruesome ending to his fight. Armstead, you want to talk about that?
card, and I saw that there wasn't I was looking at the finishes because, you know, I've yet to really – I'm not sure I'm going to get back into Bellator, but I think I am because their cards have been pretty exciting lately. But I was looking for the fight, and it wasn't on the card. So come to find out, it was actually a post-lim, which came after the main event, so it wasn't even aired. And so I was able to find the video and watch the leg break, and it was a simple – it was a leg kick that was checked by the opposing fighter named Tyson Miller, and you saw the way he moved in. I mean, Bob, I'm sure you know what the move was, but the way he moved in just to check the kick with his inside of his leg and Albert Gonzalez's leg just snapped. I mean, it was reminiscent of Anderson Silva snapping his leg a few years ago when he fought for the middleweight title against Chris Weidman, and I always found that to be just one of those freak accidents that so rarely occurs when you look at the number of leg kicks that occur in MMA. It just doesn't really happen. And the way he checked it, it was a very slight movement, and he just seemed to catch him at the right time. And you saw the fighter Tyson Miller, who checked the leg, just froze for a second. And he just threw his hands up in the air as to say to the referee, "I'm not going in. I saw that. I saw what happened. I'm backing away." It was gruesome, to say the least, though. And it makes you wonder if doing an inside leg kick is a good move anymore. So,
yeah,
that was really something else.
Yeah, Bob, you've been there.
Yeah, just like he's saying, you know, reliving Weidman and Silva. Everyone's kind of practicing that in step now with the check the leg kick. What I think it comes down to basically is angle. Cause these guys, I mean, we kick the bag, you know, the banana bag so many times and to the point where we're almost dead, you know, dead in those shins where you can swing it like a bat. And if someone just steps in the right way and you have the wrong angle, it just snaps. And being a kickboxer, you know, history, we had seen it before. And so when the first time it happened to Anderson Silva in UFC, everyone was like, "Oh my gosh," like there, a lot of times, you know, people create these things in the UFC, like this is the first time ever, but no, it's happened. It's the first time. But still unfortunate for anybody. I didn't get a chance to see it. And I wouldn't wish that on my, you know, worst enemy, maybe my ex, but not my worst enemy. So
I actually had to really hunt for it. Because it, you know, since it wasn't on the card, I was typing in Bellator 226, and it wasn't anywhere. And I had to really do some online sleuthing to be able to find the Vine. And yeah, it was definitely something you wouldn't wish on anyone. But yeah, but having even with my limited training, I heard that these types of things happen. So when I saw it occur with Anderson Silva, I had an idea. And luckily, I was standing with a guy who was a kickboxer, who basically said the same thing you just said, Bob. He goes, "It's funny, if you turn and he hits the right part of your lower knee with the right part of his shin, his leg's going to snap." And it wasn't that hard of a kick. It had no way reminiscent of like a Jose Aldo versus Uriah Faber leg kick. You know, you didn't see any of that. It was a check almost. And it just popped him, bam. And that made me go, I'm just going to stick to the heavy bag.
Well, I just found him, and I see him lifting his leg like that. I don't even think it was so much of a – he didn't even turn his hip in that much. I think he just picked it up enough that the guy hit him right below the knee, and you just got so much bone right there. And that's the hardest part. You know, you're hoping to go to shin, not shin to knee.
Right. Yeah. I worry if it's going to happen with a little more frequency because the calf kick is coming a lot more popular recently. So – you know, you got to wonder if they're going to be checking that kick a little bit differently because they know they're aiming for the inside calf because that does limit your mobility. So I hope this doesn't become something that happens more often because I really don't want to see any fighter be unable to pursue their craft. And that's what, I mean, he's going to be out for – I believe that fighter just signed a 5-fight deal, and he's going to be out for who knows how long. So you know, you know, these guys are trying to eat off of this too.
Right, and looking at it right now, we had Orthodox versus Southpaw. So that's power kick to power kick. So they're swinging a lot of power into there, you know, versus, you know, Orthodox to Orthodox or vice versa. So, yeah. I mean, hope he comes out of that. Comes back.
Butler. Yeah. We certainly wish him the very best on this because, you know, legs are not easily repaired. And that does
right.
take a long time, especially if they put screws in and everything else. And depending on the orthopod, of course, he can either be back in the ring within a year or he could be out for the rest of his life because something happened during
mm-hmm.
the surgery that we don't know anything about. But,
yeah, he broke both bones in his leg, both of them.
Yeah, that's not good. That's very painful to start out with. But the mending process is even worse.
Mm-hmm.
When it's like in the old days when they used to open a person's chest to do heart surgery, within 6 months they had a 35% mortality rate because the people couldn't take the hurt from the mending of the bones coming back in the
wow.
chest wall, and that's how painful it was, and I'm sure this is going to be just as painful with two broken bones.
Oh yeah,
you know,
I mean that was Tim, easy. That was both of them. I mean that was it's a rubber leg, and when they throw it like that and they make contact, they don't know it's
mm-hmm.
broke yet. I mean you know
mm-hmm.
When it and they go to step backwards and then there's nothing there, they fall, and then everything just kind of it's almost like. When you're a little kid, you know, you get stung by a bee or whatever, you don't know it's a sting till you look at it. You know what I mean? And
yep,
you see it,
right.
it's like, oh my gosh, you know? And
yeah,
there's
Anderson
that's
Silva said. Go ahead. I was going to say,
yeah.
Anderson Silva said he didn't feel the pain until he saw it.
Yeah. Well, you've got the adrenaline pumping. When you're in the ring and someone's crushing on you, you know, it's not the most pleasant feeling in the world, but you've got so much
sure.
adrenaline pumping through your veins. It's like you're just at work. You know what I mean? It's you don't feel it till afterwards. And then, you know, like we said before, there's never really a winner because you're both walking away beat up. But when you've won, you've got those endorphins that are carrying you through the night. Everyone wants to sleep
mm-hmm.
right when it's done, you know, unless it's like one of those real
mm-hmm.
quick, you know, Ben Askren for it or something. But, yeah. So, and then the healing process, it's even harder to come back. You know, like most fighters, you know, they feel bulletproof, you know, they're running through all their opponents and this and that, and they might have their, you know, small breaks or stitches or something like that. But when you come from a major leg or knee or even a major shoulder or back, it's almost like the second time of training is harder than the first, you know, you got to put a lot more into it.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Armstead, you had mentioned something at the opening of the show that you were getting more into Bellator because of the cards that they have. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Absolutely. I know what often happens with UFC is because you have fighters who have become a bit. I mean, I think their training is just so strong that. They're able to play a defensive game. It's almost like watching two defensive teams in the NFL where the score is going to be 9-6, like an old Ravens-Steelers game. And you're seeing that
mm-hmm.
in the UFC a bit more where fighters are getting so good at protecting themselves, but also that can lead to some relatively lackluster fights, especially amongst up-and-coming fighters who are trying to just not lose. And
mm-hmm.
That's been a bit of a knock on the UFC lately, especially the fighters, especially the fans who are not so familiar with the in and outs of the sport. But you're seeing the Bellator card, I believe it was Bellator 225. I think there was only one fight that went to decision, and there's a variety of finishes. You're getting not just the TKOs or just the one big shot to the face, but you're getting fighters who are tapping out due to strikes, and you're getting fighters who are getting a lot of different types of submissions and different types of arm holds and chokes, and you're getting fights where there's a clear winner. And as we see, MMA judging is the absolute worst judging in professional sports. It has to be MMA judging. It's just so inconsistent, and you have to wonder how much training these judges have truly had, or are they boxing judges who just happen to take MMA fights? So the Bellator cards have not been going to the judges a lot lately. So the fights may not be as technical, and I mean it's obvious if you've watched enough fights that Bellator is definitely a step below the UFC when it comes to skill of the fighter. But you can't deny the fact that they're putting on exciting fights and they're getting good cards. And they do have some elite fighters in the in Bellator. I'm mainly speaking of Ryan Bader and a Rory McDonald, and the 185-pound champ's name is leaving me at the moment. But they have definitely talent there. So, you know, you're looking at Aaron Pico, who's also a young up-and-coming fighter. Dylan Danis is a young, young and up-and-coming fighter in Bellator. So the Bellator's coming, and I think this is good for everybody. It's good that they're putting on exciting cards. They're going to get more eyeballs on it. They're going to get more fans involved, and it's going to put more pressure on the UFC, which is good for – I think it's good for the fighters.
Mm-hmm. Good. Good. Hey, Bob, Wally Zhang had a pretty handy win this last weekend over Jessica – was it Andrea?
Mm-hmm. Andrade,
Anything on it? Andrade, yeah. Anything on that?
No, I didn't get a chance to see that one. I mean, I apologize.
Mm-hmm. I thought
I got the fight.
Go ahead, Armstrong.
I saw the fight. That was of course the speculation is already sort of dancing around. Or is Zhang Weili a clean fighter? Mainly because, you know, a lot of the supplements that are coming out of China can be tainted with some performance enhancers from time to time. So I think that's going to be something that she may face down the road with some questions on that. But you can't deny her skill. She fights really, really well in the clinch, and she saw an opening and came over with a left elbow, and that was basically it for Andrade. She went down after a two or three elbows, and then once she realized that she couldn't defend the strikes anymore, she did the wise thing, which is to turtle up and just end the fight so you don't take too much damage. Mm-hmm. But Zhang Weili, she is a load. She is a load, and I think it's going to be very difficult for her to lose at 115 right now. And I'm looking forward to her fighting Joanna Jędrzejczyk, the former 115 champion who defended the belt. I want to say four or five times. So 115 is looking good right now. That's probably the deepest division in women's MMA. There's a lot of talent in there. There's a lot of good fighters, and you're going to start seeing more Japanese fighters getting involved because their women have been fighting MMA for decades. So I'm excited for the division. I think this is what the UFC needed as well, because they're trying to expand their brand in China, and she's humble. You know, she's a very good ambassador for MMA in China, and this will get. Mm-hmm. This is going to be exciting. This is going to be something good to watch for a while. Is how she develops. She's a little bit older. She's 30 years old, so she's been fighting for a while. You know, 19 fight win streak after she lost her first fight, and then hasn't lost ever since then. So this is a great story for the UFC, and she is. They're going to bring her back over here for her next fight. So she's going to fight in the United States because, of course, with the following that she can build up here, and then they're gonna put her on another card back in China again. I think probably early, or not early, but maybe next March or April. That's what I've heard is the next steps for her. So keep an eye on her. She's gonna have some good fights lately. She's already talking about wanting to fight Valentina Shevchenko, which I think is a bad idea for her at this particular moment. Go ahead and win a couple more fights, hold that belt for a little longer, and if you want to have that super fight, go ahead and take it. But for now, I think she's definitely a fighter that I'm going to be paying close attention to.
Mm-hmm. Good. But what do you think of Khabib and his last outing here?
Khabib is Khabib. He stuck to his game plan. There's no beating Khabib. We've known about Khabib for a long time, even when Conor McGregor was doing his run at the show. They just kind of kept Khabib as far away from Conor as possible because they knew it was going to happen. But he went out there. You know, it's obvious that Poirier showed up to fight. He's no slouch by any means. So I don't know. Khabib's the Michael Jordan of wrestling, if you will. You know what I mean? He's up there. He's done just phenomenal things. I was really happy that he didn't go out there and try to prove anything like he did with Conor and give a chance, because, again, like they say, you always got that striker's chance. So why even put that out there? Poirier did good trying to stay away from a couple of the takedowns. Khabib getting that, you know, he that rear naked choke. He's so strong, and you know, there's – there's times where, you know, someone puts you in a rear naked choke, you're down on the ground, and if they don't have it right, if they have your chin, you kind of let them get squeezed for a while. Because you can still breathe, and then they're just exhausting, just filling that bicep full of lactic acid. And so I'm a little worried about, you know, Khabib not having that arm strength. But Khabib's Khabib, and he just went and got it again. And I honestly think that guy pulled hard enough to dislocate his own arms. And then moving forward, so I think he did well. You know, again, they're jumping behind. They're trying to build. UFC is no slouch for marketing by any means. They're trying to build it. They're already hitting out the new kind of champion. Well, because what? He defended his title, you know, and Conor never did. You know, that's wow. That's not a new kind of champion. That's typically the typical champion does that stuff. But anyway, they're trying to get behind it. And then, you know, knocking on his door would be Tony Ferguson. Ferguson's already, you know, he's scared. You can tell. I mean, Ferguson's a great fighter in his own right. But, you know, if he's saying, well, you know, Khabib's lazy and one-dimensional. Well, yeah, but he's really good at that. And you just don't want him to go there. So you're taunting him. Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah. You know, it's just, it's like, yeah, going back to the Michael Jordan. Well, I'd rather play in golf than basketball. You know what I mean? Bring your head there.
I have to agree wholeheartedly. I mean, Robert Whittaker on his podcast recently said, 185 pound champion. He said that he just doesn't see him losing, and he goes out there, you know what he's going to do, and he does it anyway. And before he had a good second round, you saw that he was like, if I can just land a couple of good shots, maybe I can just put him away. But Khabib handled the storm and just said, okay, that's what you're going to do. I'm eventually going to get you down, and I'm going to choke you out. And his like the way he smothers fighters, because I know before they were saying he was really big for a lightweight and he was just like heavier than everybody else. Khabib came in, I think, 4 pounds lighter than Poirier did on the actual night of the fight. So he's got his diet together. He's got his nutrition together. He looks more muscular than he did before, yet his weight is definitely much more under control than it used to be. I don't know. I agree with you. I think Ferguson does. I think Ferguson knows he has he's got a puncher's chance, but Ferguson's a volume puncher. And unless he's able to catch Khabib and really get him on the ground and just ground and pound him, I just don't see how else he can do it.
Sorry about that.
I just don't see Ferguson beating him.
Yeah, he does.
Hello. Hey, Bob. How you doing?
Hey, Frank. How are you?
Doing great. Bob, we're on here with Armstead and Bob G, and we have Ty and Zito are going to be joining us in a very few minutes. A couple things for anybody that doesn't know, this is Bob Alexander. Bob is one of the premier boxing announcers in the state of Florida. He's a member of the Florida Boxing Hall of Fame. He's done quite a few fights nationally, internationally, and within the state. So, Bob, why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch? Well, first of all, congratulations on Bob 102.9. You want to bring our listeners up on that?
Well, that's a bit of an inside joke. I actually, that's kind of a coincidence, that whole thing. But I actually work for iHeartRadio in Port Charlotte. I work for two different stations. I do a morning show on 1580 AM, WCCF. It's a local talk show. And then I host a music show on one of the other stations, which is CB104.9. I do that easy listening music from 2 to 6 in the afternoon. So the Bob FM thing is more of a, it's kind of a coincidence, kind of a running joke. But I do stay busy with radio, and I've been ring announcing for almost 30 years, and I love it. And I've been very lucky to do a lot of shows in the state of Florida in the last year. It's been really busy.
Can you tell us some of the fights that that you've been doing lately?
I went to Dubai. I've been to Kazakhstan twice in the last few years. Did some shows there overseas. I've been to Trinidad. Did some MMA down there. I've been lucky enough to just to travel the country. I did a great show in Detroit last month. In downtown Detroit, that was a lot of fun because that's my hometown. And but the rest of in the state of Florida have been great because I've had a chance to see some really nice looking up and coming fighters, which I'll be happy to mention a little bit.
Sure, let us know. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, the first and foremost is a young man out of Tampa by the name of Mark Reyes Jr. He's 10-0. I believe with 8 knockouts. Not only is he a really fine prospect, but he's one of the finest young men I've ever had a chance to meet in the sport. He does a lot of work with the Kids Cancer Hospital up in Tampa, raising money for them.
Right.
He's just a real gentleman and just a really talented young fighter who looks like he could really make some noise as a welterweight as he continues. I've also seen a couple of really nice-looking fighters down in the Miami area the last several months. Young man by the name of Melvin Lopez. He's a bantamweight. He's undefeated. He's already won a couple of junior titles. Very, very impressive-looking fighter. And a young man by the name of Harold Calderon has a huge following down in Miami. He's also undefeated. I believe he's 19-0 at this point. He also won won the WBC Latino belt a couple fights ago, but all three of those young men, I think, are going to make some real noise in their respective divisions representing the state of Florida. And it's just a lot of fun being able to watch these guys come up through the ranks and early in their careers and then, eventually, move on to, maybe a title opportunity. But that's been a lot of fun, following those guys. And, I love doing the fights nationally and internationally, but I'm particularly fond of doing the fights in Florida because, this is where I live and these are all people that I get to know and, get to know their families. And it's just a great part of the sport for me.
Yeah. Hey, Bob, just earlier, Armstead was questioning the MMA judges and thought maybe some of them may have come over from boxing. I know you went through this program with Pam. Can you tell our listeners what it takes to be a judge?
Sure, absolutely. Primarily, they like for you to start out in the amateurs doing, and thankfully, there's a lot of amateur shows now across the state of Florida. There was a time in the last 5 years or so where it was kind of bare. And there wasn't a lot going on, but it's been a very busy year for the amateurs, which is great because not only does it give the young fighters a chance to learn and grow, but officials as well. So they generally like you to start by judging in the amateurs. And after you get a little bit of experience under your belt doing that, then you become what's called a trailing judge. That's where you go to shows, go to the pro shows around the state, and you judge. It's a practice thing. You sit at ringside. You score the fight, you turn in your scorecard to the head official who later, after the show will review it, sit down with you and say, all right, I want you to explain to me why you scored the fight for this guy, or why you scored this round this way when you get to explain, what you're seeing. And then they can offer you tips on, this is what you need to look for and that sort of thing. And you have to get a certain number of rounds in. For example, if you go to a show and there's, 6 four-round fights and they all go the distance, well, you just earned yourself 24 rounds of judging and you have to reach a certain level. I don't know what the exact number is. I know it's well over 100 rounds. I think it's 150 that you have to log in. And once you fulfill your commitments to that learning and if the officials believe that you have what it takes to be a competent judge, then they will start assigning you as a full-time judge. That's pretty much how it works.
Hey, Bob, this is Ty. And guys, please forgive me for my lateness. Bob, quick question. Let me ask you this. Hey, Armstead, obviously want to talk to you. What ramifications or different protocols do they have in order for a judge who constantly turns in, I don't even want to say egregious scorecards, but just scorecards that are kind of divergent from popular opinion and from consistently from other judges' scorecards. What are the protocols to go ahead and get that judge
on track? It's really up to the discretion of the, you know, head official. Generally, it's the assistant executive director who's in charge of that sort of thing. He will sit down not only with the trailing judges, but when if a judge becomes full-time and starts working, after every show, they all sit down as a group, the judges, the referees, the inspectors. That's one thing I love about the state of Florida. You know, I've seen a lot of states that have a very lax commission, to be perfectly charitable there. But in Florida, they run it pretty well. There's always going to be criticism and issues and things like that. But I found the state of Florida to be quite efficient with the way they take care of their officials. Again, they have the meeting right after the show, and you know, then they have they'll always have little one-on-ones. If the official says, "I'm not comfortable with this decision, I want you to explain it to me," well, then the official gets called on the carpet and has to explain, well, you know, what did you see in this fight that would make you score it for this guy, you know, when there was such a divergence with the other two. Now, you're going to get fights that are seen from different angles, and sometimes you're going to get a close decision, you know, that's going to go, you know, two scores for one guy and one score for the other, or sometimes they call it a draw. But, you know, if you have two judges score a shutout for fighter A and the other judge scores it a shutout for fighter B, then you got to sit down and go, all right, what did you see? Why did you go this route? What made you think this guy won? And if you have too many situations where a guy is so far out in left field with his scoring, or if it's blatant that he's maybe scoring for a hometown fighter, that's when the official, the commission has to step in and say, hey, look, you're here to be impartial. You're not here to root for any fighters. You know, that's why they ask you, even for me as a ring announcer, when I apply for my license, they always ask, do you have any stake in any fighter in any way? So they want to make sure that, you know, you don't have a cousin out there who's fighting, you know, and you get the chance to be a judge for him. They don't want that. You know, they don't want a guy that knows somebody or has a stake in somebody to be judging, because that's when the question of corruption comes in. And the last thing we need in our sport is something like that. So it's totally up to the discretion of the state commission. But I found that they've been very, very effective. If there's a judge that is consistently turning in scorecards that don't make any sense, they will get called on the carpet. And if they can't come up with an explanation as to why they scored a certain way, they simply won't be used as a judge anymore. It's totally up to the discretion of the state. They can say, you know what, we don't trust this guy. We don't think he's competent, or we think he has some kind of an agenda. They just won't use them anymore. And that's just, you know, there's no guarantee that you're going to get work even if you complete the training. It's up to the officials, you know, that run the program to decide whether or not you get a gig or not. But they're pretty good about that. As long as you show that you're willing to be fair, you know, on both sides, then generally you're going to have a chance to judge a lot of fights. That's how they work it. But there are protocols in place to protect the integrity of the sport.
All right.
In your observations, have you seen the same protocols that are put in for amateur MMA fights? Because the thing about the judging for the boxing matches is, as you said, if you get two fights, let's say you get two full decision fights, you get 24 rounds. That in MMA, that's going to take 6 to 8 fights, whereas in boxing, you take 2 to 3. So I'm just thinking of the recent fight with Paul Felder and Edson Barboza, where one judge scored a 30-27 for Barboza and one scored a 30-27 for Felder. And that and both coaches said there's no way that fight was all for one guy or another. So I mean, have you seen anything on the MMA side of that to kind of mitigate that? Are MMA judges getting the same level of scrutiny and training that the boxing judges are getting?
It's getting to that point. And of course, you got to remember that, you know, in the long picture, in the big picture, MMA is still relatively young.
It's very
and,
new. Yes, you are correct.
They're yeah, they're. I mean, I got to be honest with you. I love doing MMA. I love announcing MMA fights. It's given me a lot of work that I didn't have when I first started in the business. But
yeah.
I am still after nearly 20 years of doing MMA, I'm still learning myself how to score and what a certain thing means in there. So it's not easy when you have. I mean, boxing is pretty straightforward. You have, you know, clean punching and aggressiveness, defense, ring generalship. That's the standards that they put out there for boxing. And compared to MMA, I think it's pretty simple. MMA is very complicated because of the rules, the many ways you can win, the way that you control a fight. I mean, some people might sit and look and go, this guy is completely getting his butt beat, but somebody who knows MMA is going to say, no, that strategy, he's actually winning the fight because of the way he's manipulating his opponent. And I'll sit there and go, what, really? So I think right now it's a matter of making sure that these guys and these gals that are scoring and trying to be judges for MMA, you know, they need guidance. And you know, the state commission, I think, has really stepped it up recently to try and make sure that there are competent officials for the amateurs and the pros when it comes to MMA. But it's tough because, you know, a lot of the judges don't want to do MMA. Some of them are just want to do boxing. So, you know, getting the judges in place is not an easy thing. And you see a lot of duplicate assignments for referees and judges in the MMA business because there's not a whole lot of officials out there that are really qualified and experienced in MMA. And amateur MMA is basically, it's really in its infancy here in the state of Florida. I know it's been around for a little while, but, you know, as far as getting opportunities and having a lot of shows, that's really just been kind of recent. So I think they're doing the best they can to try and get, you know, trained and competent officials for the MMA. I just think they're looking at a numbers game right now, you know, so it's probably not to the level that you would hope or you would want at this point. I think they're going to get there, but it's just going to continue to take time to build a base. I mean, again, boxing's been around, you know, since the turn of last century, you know, the 1800s and, you know, you've had a long time in the state of Florida to build a good base of officials, which most of whom I work with and have for years. But the MMA side is so new. So it's just a matter of the state is really taking it more seriously. They're you know, they're giving more scrutiny to the amateurs. But that goes for amateur boxing, too. The state is becoming more involved, even though USA Boxing pretty much oversees most of the amateur boxing matches. The state of Florida is really starting to take a better role in participating and making sure that the people that they promote to the pros are well qualified. They just don't want to grab anybody.
You know, I also think MMA, because they emulated the 10-point must system from boxing, I also think that's been problematic. And I know they thought about
it. Yeah, I agree.
They've reevaluated a couple times, but it's obviously problematic. Specifically, the other thing, too, with MMA is you only have three-round fights. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, and obviously, they can't be 10-round fights. But it makes each round, you know, magnifies, obviously, the importance of each round. I was watching the Justin Gaethje, Dustin Poirier fight, like, right after literally just this past, you know, obviously in preparation for Gaethje's fight with Cerrone. But I was watching that fight, you know, Gaethje had a point taken away from him for two eye pokes. And the moment he gets the point taken away from him, it's a five-round fight. It's just like, damn. You know what I mean? Like, just in that instant, you're in jeopardy. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, again, with all the grappling, how do you score takedowns? How do you score control? What if a guy's on the ground? You take a guy like Tony Ferguson who's actively trying to finish from the ground. I remember the King Mo Gegard Mousasi fight from years ago where took Gegard down at random, and Gegard destroyed him from the bottom, literally destroyed him. And I was like, well, Gegard won that fight as far as I'm concerned, but obviously King Mo won it because of the takedown. So I think because, like you said, of the different skill sets, it's still in its infancy in comparison to boxing, and then they just really just transferred the 10-point watch system over to MMA. So they didn't really create their own scoring criteria specific for the sport, which may need to happen at some point in time.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the Paul Felder, Edwin Barboza decision. And I love Paul Felder. We actually have mutual friends. Really a big fan of Paul Felder's. But
no, I'm a huge fan of Paul Felder.
29-28. Lost it 29-28.
He
clear
did lose that
fight. Clear as day. Clear as day. And yeah. I knew when I got on the phone and I heard Bob talking about scoring, I said, Armstead's bitching about the Paul Felder, Edwin Barboza fight. I knew it.
Exactly right, man. I sure was.
Bob, do you have any shows coming up in the future, in the near future?
Yeah, actually, I've got a show in Miami. A longtime promoter and Florida Boxing Hall of Famer Henry Grooms is promoting a show in Miami at the Joe Celestin Center a week from this Friday. So I'll be down there doing that. Then I have an amateur show, actually an amateur boxing show, a regular series that I announced down in Bonita Springs, something I've been doing for several years. And that'll pretty much close out the month of September. And then I'll be taking a little bit of time off to enjoy my wedding and my honeymoon. And then I'll be
–
thank you, thank you. Thank you so much. Looking forward to it, and then it's going to finish off with a bang. I've got several shows lined up for the end of the year, back-to-back shows in October, back-to-back shows in November, late November. There's another show in Tampa. So yeah, I'm going to be busy as the end of the year rolls on. It usually gets busy in fall, and then, you know, we finish up usually right around the end of November, maybe a show in early December, but for the most part, December is kind of a wash. You know, everybody is ready for the holidays and, you know, the NFL bowl or the college bowl games and everything. Boxing and MMA kind of shut, not really shut down, but scale back for the holidays. And then, of course, right after we get through a New Year's into early January, mid-January, it starts to pick up again. And by February, I'm rolling. I'm back, you know, busy as ever. So it's great. I love it. You know, I've got some things that are in planning that I can't really mention right now because they're not confirmed, but next year could be a very big year for me as far as international travel. I've got some
nice
shows that are lining up, and as soon as I get the confirmation of those, I'll be happy, more than happy to tell you all about it because I'm really excited about the possibilities. But I'm the kind of person that, I get just as excited to do a local amateur show as I do a show, you know, in Dubai or Kazakhstan or anywhere else.
Right.
That's just who I am. I don't, you know, save anything. I don't leave anything, you know, on the table in the closet when I go out to do a show. Whether it's an amateur show, a pro show, state, local, whatever, I always give everything I have and try to put on the best job that I can. For every promoter, it just doesn't matter. You know, I don't discriminate. Oh, this guy's only got 200 people in the audience. Well, you know what? He's going to get the best that I have for those 200 people. You know, I mean, that's just the way I look at it. It's so much a labor of love as a matter of, you know, oh, well, this is what I do for a living. No, this is what I do because I love it and I enjoy it.
Right.
Hey, Bob, you know, quick question. What kind of prep work do you do for your voice and for your throat before you go on? And what do you do even, you know, off time to maintain your voice and throat? I would imagine that it would take work.
It's really, and this is going to sound very cliche, but it's so much of it is drinking a lot of water, especially the day of a show,
right.
and drinking, you know, keeping hydrated during the show. I always make sure that I have, you know, some lozenges in case I – because there are times that, like, for example, when I do a show in Miami and I do a lot of Spanish down there, and, you know, the Spanish fans go absolutely nuts for their fighters. And, you know, when I start rolling my R's and start doing the, you know, the Roberto kind of thing, you know, they go absolutely nuts. They love that. Well, it's a matter of respect too, because when I'm able to do that, it shows that I respect the fans and I respect the fighters and their heritage. So, but that's exciting for me.
Exactly.
But sometimes when I get too excited and the crowd's loud, you know, I got to make sure I have, you know, like a lozenge or two standing by and pop that baby in there and, you know, keep myself under control. But it's a matter of, you got to know how to pace yourself, especially if you've got 9 or 10 fights. You know, you can't go crazy for every single fight. You gotta know when to really turn up the volume and that kind of thing. So, but it's just a lot of, you know, a lot of hydration, you know, keeping the voice loose. You know, I drink a lot of tea with lemon when I need to. Lemon is great for my voice. So there's no real big secret. It's just a matter of making sure that, you know, if I go a day, you know, before a show or the day of a show without drinking a lot of water, then I can be in trouble, because then you get dry and then your voice gets cracky. And, you know, you really, it sounds cliche, but hydrating the whole day and into the night is the best way to protect your voice, no matter what you're doing.
Well, Bob, we want to thank you for your time. It's always, just so everybody knows, you know, I like to be upfront with everybody. I coached Bob in a semi-pro football team, and his son. When you can see how he gets excited about things, this guy is the calmest person you ever want to meet in the parking lot. But you put a helmet and pads on he or his son, and they will tear your head off. And I always appreciate Bob and his son and now his grandchildren. They've always been very kind to us. So Bob, we appreciate
it. Frank, I appreciate it. I your friendship is very important to me, and I've always enjoyed being around you, whether it was playing football or at the fights or just talking on the radio here. I mean, you're such a great guy. You and your family have meant so much to me, and I'm just your friendship means the world, and I'm happy to be on the show anytime you ever want me.
Okay, Bob, thanks a million, and again, congratulations on your coming nuptials, and I'll talk to you sometime later on this week,
Bob.
Thank you, gentlemen, I really appreciate it. Have a great night, and I look forward to talking to you down the road.
Take care, sir.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Thanks. Good night.
Ty, what do you think about Joseph Parker agreed to fight Derek Chisora on the 26th of
October? Did you see
October?
The press conference?
Yeah.
Did you see the press conference? Derek Chisora went off because he
tantrum.
And Joseph Parker are the co-feature. They are the co-feature in London for Regis Prograis and Josh Taylor, who's Irish.
Right.
So he was really not happy about that. And he was literally was like, pay me more or put me on the main, you know, on the main event. And so that was actually the big news coming out of the press conference. But that's a pretty entertaining bill with those two fighting, as well as Regis Prograis against Josh Taylor in completion of the WBCC Super Series at 140.
Right.
So it'll crown the Ring Magazine 140-pound champion. So that's a pretty big deal. But commercially, you know, the big guys always draw more than the little guys. And Chisora had a point, although I don't know if that was the proper place or the proper way to make it.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Bob, UFC banned BJ Penn since he had that bar fight. That was pretty embarrassing for after you saw the – I don't know if you saw the video of it, but it was pretty embarrassing. What's your thoughts on that?
I totally disagree with that. I think they're making a role, or not a role model, but making a point out of BJ Penn when they've got so many. They've got John Jones go after Conor McGregor for not, like, BJ looked like he was trying to get out of that. You know what I mean? Kind of had his hands up and was backing away, and then the guy cold cocked him, and BJ went down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the UFC is jumping on that as, oh, look how we're coming down on fighting now. But BJ's not one of their main draws right now. They're going to keep protecting. You know, I don't think the ethics were there yet with boxing. It needs to mature, like having Bob on a minute ago and hearing him talk about being a ref and a judge and that kind of stuff. And I think in the East Coast more as well, because it's predominantly boxing. I mean, a lot of boxing out here on the East Coast compared to, like, the West Coast or Midwest. And so so it's been developed for a long, long time. And the states, and there's good people involved, and there's officials, and there's people pointing fingers, versus the UFC, I don't think has that ethic talk in the beginning, like, okay, let's be as fair as possible. I think these guys are still, you know, especially in the, you know, coming from Colorado, I was out there for a while. These judges know who, I mean, whether they work for the quote unquote state, the promoter's paying their wages. They know that,
sure.
You know, they can
sure.
tell the vibe of a room. And when these things, just like UFC, you know, Armstead brought that up earlier, you know, you don't want a decision in the UFC, because it's not going to go your way. It's going to go to the way the person that sold the most tickets. Versus mm-hmm. Bellator is starting to at least have better matchmaking and stuff. So, mm-hmm. you know, going back to the ethics of it all, I just think they're making an example out of BJ Penn, which is sad because he was a good dude.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Ty.
You know, I'm going to speak on that right quick. You know, let me speak on that
go
right ahead. Quick. I think the BJ Penn footage was freaking embarrassing. It was absolutely embarrassing, but it wasn't embarrassing to me. It wasn't embarrassing because a fighter got punched with his hands down and knocked down. Before I saw that, I saw the footage of BJ on top of the guy pounding him, and I was just as embarrassed when I saw that. The reason why the footage was embarrassing, where BJ was pounding the guy, apparently the guy knocked him down is what you saw, and then the fight started, and we caught BJ on top of the guy, the guy's face down, BJ's on top of him, ground to pound him. The reason why the footage was embarrassing primarily is because it's the second such footage to come out in like a matter of a couple months. It's not embarrassing to me. It's embarrassing to BJ's family. It's embarrassing to his kids.
Sure.
It has nothing to do with him being a fighter. It has everything to do with him being a 40-year-old man who should, you know, again, conduct himself in a way that doesn't put him in those situations. Not embarrassing for the fact that he's a fighter. You know, you're out there, you're getting your stuff, you got to defend yourself. You know, it could go down either way. A fight is a fight. Two people have a fist. None of that matters. What matters is being mature and responsible enough to recognize you have kids and keep yourself out of that situation. As far as the UFC's ethics go, they are number one bullshit. To quote my man Khabib, this is number one bullshit. Because the fact of the matter is the reason why they're cutting BJ is because they can afford to, because he's on an 0-9
right.
streak. He hasn't won since like 2011.
Right.
If
yeah.
Conor McGregor, no matter what you think, he just punched a freaking 50-year-old dude, man, who was at a bar for
right.
no reason. You know what I mean? Regardless of what the guy may have said, he just punched him. And, you know, Dana White doesn't talk about the punch. He talks about Conor's apology. So, again, number one bullshit. Bob is absolutely right about the ethics of it. I'm more embarrassed for BJ's family. I think, you know, as a family man, he needs to get himself together. I hope he gets the help that he needs. That's what I hope comes from this. But as far as him being cut from fighting, if you're willing to keep him without the footage, then keep him specifically because of the footage, because obviously he needs fighting or something to kind of keep his life together at this point in time. So
sure.
I was really disgusted by the UFC's response to that. Extremely disgusted.
Let me ask you another question. I was kind of shocked. It took Vasily Lomachenko 12 rounds to finally get a decision over Luke Campbell. Now, Luke Campbell's not a slouch by any means, but you would think that with the difference in the number of fights that Lomachenko had versus Campbell, that should not have taken him that long. What's your thoughts on that one?
Well, you would think if you looked at the scorecards and if you only read the articles or read the comments or the scorecards, you would think that Lomachenko won a wide 12-round decision. That's not the case at all.
Yeah, no.
I watched the fight by myself, and when I first watched the fight, I thought Lomachenko won by virtue of the 11th round knockdown or maybe another round. He won by – for my book, he won by no more than 1 or 2 points.
Right.
Then I had Zito watch the fight because Zito didn't watch it live. So I had Zito watch the fight. And Zito thought that it was a draw. He thought the knockdown spared Lomachenko a draw. So, and the reason why I was like, Zito, you got to watch this fight. I'm just curious what you think. I didn't tell him anything about it, but I was like, am I off? So I saw a significantly closer fight than everyone else. And I know why, because I was viewing the fight objectively. I wasn't viewing the fight as a Lomachenko cheerleader. Right now, and this happens in MMA too, but I see it right now more in boxing. I feel that MMA fans are more pure. I feel boxing's kind of tainted. But we don't have a lot of fight fans. We have a lot of fans of fighters. And it's bleeding its way into the commentary, and I'm finding it's bleeding its way into the scoring. The fight that I saw was a very close tactical fight. He hit Lomachenko with a shot, and he buzzed Lomachenko, and it was not mentioned. Lomachenko roared back that round and hurt Luke. And the narrative should have been, wow, Lomachenko came back from adversity and hurt Luke. But they act like the adversity never happened. It was just, it was remarkable to me to watch a fight and hear the commentary and then see the judging so tonally blind to what actually was going on. It's really bad. So then I turn around and I watch MMA and I watch what I think is a very bad decision. I don't think it's a robbery, but I'm going to go. It's right there with Paul Felder and Edwin Barbosa. And what I'm starting to recognize is, unfortunately, the guys who know best how to score the sports are the guys I talk to when I come on the radio on Tuesday evenings. That's a freaking shame because none of us are getting paid to do it. it's kind of actually souring some of the fights. I watched a great fight and I enjoyed it, but I'm the kind of guy, in my spare time, when I have spare time, I like to read, the articles, and I like to read comments and see, what everybody's thinking. And I'm just reading a bunch of foolishness. I'm reading fans of fighters. I'm reading the politics of boxing. It's amazing how this social media has everyone so into the politics of the sport as opposed to the sport itself. I'm hearing more about Kobe Covington and Jorge Masvidal's beef. Now I'm seeing Dustin Poirier say, Kobe, if I see you at the gym, it's on site. And it's just like, wait a minute. It's like, why is all this – why are these the articles I'm reading – instead about about the magnificent performances these guys are putting on or who they're fighting next.
Right.
So I'm kind of it's all becoming kind of reality TV, and unfortunately, from a judging perspective and a commentary perspective, it's starting to follow suit. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you used that that word politics, because we're going to do a every year we have to do a. A special public service announcement, and tonight we're going to interview, and he's on the line here now, a man I worked with at the Sarasota County Sheriff's Office for many years, Paul Fearn. Paul is running for the office of Sheriff of Sarasota County. Paul, how you doing tonight?
Good. How you doing, sir?
We're doing great. We're doing great. Paul, I know your background, but our listeners don't. And so could you give us a thumbnail sketch of who Paul is and what he's about?
Sure. I'm 53 years old, married to wife Joanne for 3 years. We've been together for 8. I have 2 sons. One's in Minnesota. He's 26 years old, and he's a lead hematologist at emergency room at a hospital up there. My youngest son, who's 23, is in the U.S. Navy, stationed in San Diego. Joanne has 3 daughters, age 31, 28, and 25, and we have 2 grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a nutshell, that's
family, sir.
Thanks.
Yeah, nice family.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. Paul, how many years of direct service did you have to the citizens of Sarasota County?
Well, if you go a little bit further back, I started in 95 in Manatee County in Corrections, and I came to Sarasota in 97 in patrol. So from 97 to about 2011, I got about 15 years total in Sarasota County in Manatee combined.
And what units were you assigned to?
I was in Corrections in Manatee, and in Sarasota I was in patrol. And then I spent about 80% of my time in Sarasota in special ops assigned to the K-9 division. 80% or so of my time in Sarasota was special ops K-9.
Mm-hmm. And you were also a member, when you say special ops, I don't know if everybody understands, it also includes ERT and SWAT. So that you were always a frontline person. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, specialty units, ERT, SWAT, those type of things where you don't really respond to in-service calls unless it's a canine you were assigned. You would respond to in-progress calls that are violent in nature, where somebody fled on foot with a weapon or something like that, or battered somebody, or robbery or burglary or things like that. So, yeah, frontline guy.
And you, at one point you had left the agency and advanced to the federal marshals. Can you explain what your position was there?
Yeah, I was in. I was actually on working canine in Sarasota County when President Bush was here speaking at an elementary school, and the Secret Service comes out a week in advance to learn the normal flow of traffic. And I got to be tight with one of the Secret Service guys. And when they left in a hurry, nobody knew what was going on. He had sent me an email a few days after saying that the federal air marshals were hiring, and if I wanted to apply to that, he would get my application to the powers that be. At the time, there was only, I think, 33 air marshals that were flying. So yeah. After 9/11, they ramped it up pretty good. I think they went up to like 3,000 at some point. The numbers is they kind of keep it secret, but I think it was at 3,000 or something. And so I took that position, and I was assigned in Minneapolis. Not many people wanted to go there, but that's where I was from. So it was home to me. So that's where I started. I was in federal air marshals for about 9 years. And within the air marshals, they have different, like any other agency, they have different things that you can go into. They have plainclothes and uniform division, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security. You see those guys around nowadays when they went to Puerto Rico for the hurricane last year. And we go uniform, just basically crowd control and things like that and public service. But the plainclothes part was pretty unique. We did large events like the Super Bowl and World Series where we had bomb detection equipment. God. And we'd walk amongst, you know, large crowds, and when our machines would go off, we would just kind of narrow it down to who it was focusing on. We kind of plucked them out of the crowd and talked to them and see what they had on them and that kind of thing. So we did all kinds of things around the world with that equipment. It was pretty impressive to see what that equipment does and where it's used. It's pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm. You were also a terrorist chaser, as I remember. Is there anything you can tell us about that? I said you were also a terrorist chaser.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we would take top flight security flights across, and they're determined by our threat matrix team out in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And we would be assigned to certain things, and we would go to, you know, wherever people are going, Amsterdam, Netherlands, China, Japan, all over the world. So it was pretty, the training was phenomenal. You'd be gone for 4 or 5 days, come back and have a training day, then pack and do your laundry and go out again. So it was pretty, it's a great job for a young guy with no family, but it kind of wrecked havoc on a family guy. It's a great job, but man, the traveling was tough. But you know, it stood for something that we all signed up for, and you know, didn't want it to ever happen again on our watch. You know, so it was kind of a personal thing for all of us that did it. We left our agencies back, you know, back wherever they came from. Everybody came from all over the country to do this, and it was pretty impressive to see all of us come together with just kind of like a calling that you don't really recall, but you stood up for it. You know, it was kind of a pride thing. It was pretty impressive and unique.
Yeah. And what security clearances do you have?
I think they're probably expired by now, but I had top secret clearance. Top secret clearance as an air marshal, and then I also had a position of memorandum clearance where I would download top secret information from CIA and things like that I had to download and print off and put it in a briefcase and handcuff it to my wrist and walk it down to the special agent in charge and sign off on it. It was those are the two that I had, but I think they're probably expired by now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does your opponent have any of those clearances?
Oh, I don't. I would highly doubt that. Yeah, you know the memorandum one. There was only 26. I was 26, but there was 25 other guys in the country that had my clearance as the memorandum part. So it was pretty impressive. You know, if you were to ask me, you know, 18 years ago, that you would have top secret clearance and do this and be downloading information and walking it down and. I would say, yeah, okay, but I did. It was pretty impressive, and it was a job that I loved it. Just the traveling was just caught to me. So,
But Now, as a businessman in Sarasota area, I know that you and your wife have worked with a lot of people in the community to raise funds for different organizations. Is there any project you want to tell our listeners about?
We've had a couple of fundraisers within the last year. We did one for a gentleman, Chase Gordy, who was a gunshot wound victim in Bradenton. He was on life support for a while, so we did a fundraising thing for his family. He's now well on the road to recovery. I think he's up in Orlando or something at a recovery facility up there working on getting his mobility back. And we just did one for Daniel Martello. It's called 100 Beats, and he's on the list for a heart transplant. So we held a fundraiser for those people and try to get as much as we can to, I mean, something to contribute to the family. You know, it's pretty expensive to get on the list for a heart transplant. You have to have $100,000 in the bank account even to put you on the list. So it's pretty expensive.
Mm. Yeah.
So.
I know you have a website. Can you let our listeners know what that website is and how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's fern2020.com, or you can go to fern4sheriff.com. Either one links to the same site. So pretty easy to get a hold of us, and we'll answer pretty quick. So,
is there anything that we've missed here in these last couple questions that you want to let our listeners know?
No, just that it's something that I'm passionate about, and I'm a boots on the ground frontline guy, and I think that's the way agencies it should be. The leader should have experience and being on the road and knowing every single call that has come out in his county, his or her county,
mm-hmm.
and know how to handle each and every call. And
sure.
I've been there and I've done that, and I got the credentials to back that up.
Right.
Absolutely.
And I know that you had a chance meeting with a certain MLB player. do you want to let everybody know that one?
We went to Aaron Jaco's gym to talk with Aaron a little bit, and as we were walking out, he said his next client coming in was Bobby Bonilla. So I'd never met Bobby Bonilla before.
Wow.
That was pretty impressive. Pretty large individual.
it was even more impressive that Butch had you tell a story that wasn't about a Philly, so.
Hey, he didn't mention the Phillies at all today, so.
No.
So you've had a pretty good day.
I'm going to keep my mouth shut. Well, Paul, we want to thank you for your time tonight. We appreciate your coming on and taking your time away. I know you're busy at the store and with your family, and we wish you a lot of luck in the race. I know that you have all the credentials that would make a very very good sheriff in Sarasota County, something that's really lacking at this point. But
I appreciate that. Thank you, Frank. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I was getting a kick out of listening to your show. That was pretty informative. I didn't know that you got that in depth. Pretty impressive.
Oh yeah,
if you're free,
guys,
you should come on sometime and hang out with us, man.
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Anyway, come on and hang out with us. Absolutely, talk fights with us.
That would be awesome.
Sure.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah,
that'd be great. I actually did a little bit of jiu-jitsu with Gracie Jiu Jitsu up in Minnesota. There was a gym called Warrior
Cove. Oh, well, dude, you got to come on. You know what you're talking about. Come on. Yeah.
Well, I'm kind of a novice, but it's been a while. But, back surgery later. And
I
still got a little bit in me.
You still watch fights when you can?
Oh, absolutely.
Still watch fights when you can?
Yeah.
Oh, well, then
you
got to come on. Yeah. Talk to Mr. Fern and have him on. Talk to the sheriff and have him on.
Sure.
Anytime.
Sure.
Yep. Anytime.
Sure. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Bob. We appreciate it. We're up against our time limit here.
Yep.
And, Bob, I appreciate all the input you had, you put in for tonight's show. Ty, it's always a pleasure to have you on, and with your knowledge, it's so extensive. And we'll see you guys. Bob, we'll see you next week. Ty, you want to lead us out?
Hey, it's been a great show. Please forgive me again for being late. I'm sorry I'm having a hard time getting on. Just really busy with this project. Bob Alexander, Bob Kern, and obviously Armstead. And don't we have, do we have the other Bob Orange too?
Yes, sir, I'm with you.
Yeah, Bob's here.
There it is. We got everybody on. It's been a great show. It's great talking to you guys. I'm so sorry I wasn't here for the MMA portion because, damn, I got a lot to say. But I will absolutely try to be back next week. I'll talk to you guys. Bob is our co-pilot. Coach Mel is watching over us. Everyone, please have a joyful and just be well this week.
Ladies and gentlemen, these programs are brought to you each and every night of the week in grateful appreciation to the men and women of the United States Armed Forces and the men and women of Police and Fire Services. When you're out there and you see somebody in a uniform, please acknowledge them. It's a very tough time domestically and in foreign lands for men and women in uniform at this point in time. These programs are dedicated to those who lost their lives in the line of duty. Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman David Curtis, Patrolman Jeffrey Colcap, Sergeant Thomas Batinger, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazowitz, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, San Diego Officer Mike Hendler, Lieutenant Mike Zerba, Newcastle County Police, Patrolman Anafu Crispin of Lakeland PD, Chief Al Hogan, Longbow Key Police Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Highway Patrolman Highway Patrolman Alonzo Moses, Philadelphia Highway Patrol, Highway Patrolman Brian Lazaro, Philadelphia Highway Patrol, Highway Patrolman Brian Murphy, Plymouth Township PA Highway Patrol, Lieutenant Bob Neary, Philadelphia Fire Department, Sergeant Mike Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Office, Deputy Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, Deputy Jonathan Scott Pine, Orange County Sheriff's Department, Patrolman Robert Germain, Windermere, Florida Police Department, Trooper Chelsea Richards, Florida Highway Patrol, Lieutenant Joyce Craig Lewis, Philadelphia Fire Department, Patrolman Charlie Condit, Tarpon Springs Police Department, Hillsborough County Deputy Sheriff Charlie Kotloff, Delaware State Trooper Sergeant Rodney Bond, Captain Chris Leach, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Jerry Ficus, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Ardith Hope, Wilmington Fire Department, FDLE Special Inspector Vinny Galaccio, Delaware State Trooper Corporal Stephen Bauer, Kissimmee Patrol Officer Matt Baxter, Kissimmee Sergeant Sam Howard, Captain Matt Letourneau, Philadelphia Fire Department, Deputy Bill Gentry, Highland County Sheriff's Department, Deputy Clay Zerba, Clay County Sheriff's Department, Deputy Natalie Corona, L.A. County Sheriff's Office, Deputy April Rodriguez, Pasco County Sheriff's Office, Officer Robert McEachin, Biloxi, Kentucky Police Department. My brothers and sisters, although you may be 10-7 at this point in time, at some time we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Until that time, may the rose rise up to meet you. May the winds be always at your back. May the sun shine lightly on your face and the rains fall lightly on your field. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your families always in the hollow of his hands. Good night. God bless and have a great weekend.
Shem alek ma yelama Shem ma hezahir ma Son Hashem nevorat fed Hakuig again ma Sing his praise.
County dispatched in 1999. All units be advised, 1999 has responded to his last emergency. May God rest his soul. Love you and we miss you.